Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are about to celebrate here on this program with this conversation the Emancipation Day here in Maryland and its history and what that means. We are joined once again by Lisa Crowley, Resource Center Manager for the Reginald F. Luce Museum of African American History and Culture. Lisa, always good to have you in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Mark.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Barbara Krauthammer, who is Associate Professor of History and the Graduate Program Director at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, co-author of Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery. And Dr. Barbara Krauthammer, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
And she and Deborah Willis, her co-author, will discuss the book we're talking about, Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery, at the Reginald F. Luce Museum on Saturday, November the 1st at 1 o'clock. More information at 443-263-1816 or visit rflewismuseum.org. So, Lisa, let me start with you and then we'll go to Dr. Krauthammer. I've gotten a number of emails from people saying, please, this is Emancipation Day is coming up. You can't forget it. You have to talk about it, which we had intended to do. But talk about why this is so unique in history, and especially with Maryland's position in it.
This is so important because as a border state, Maryland was not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as you said earlier, there was a popular vote that was held in October of that year. And the vote, thankfully, was to abolish slavery. And so it was not effective until the new state constitution, November 1st, 1864. Prior to that, though, really in the whole Civil War era from roughly 1862 to the end of the war, in the state of Maryland, there were as many free African Americans as there were slaves. In the northern counties from Baltimore County and north, all the economic growth was basically coming out of the northern part of the state. And so enslaved people were basically negotiating their way out of slavery. Those who were working in the shipyards, those who were working in the mills, it was better to negotiate a wage and pay someone a fair wage instead of having a slave for life. So all these factors over time led to the emancipation of slavery in Maryland. Two other key factors, when D.C. emancipation took place in April of 1862, there were African-American Marylanders who were freed under D.C. emancipation because they were hired out slaves to the district.
Huh.
Okay, so they were hired out from Montgomery County, the lower part of Montgomery County. They were hired out from Prince George's County, and so they were free. And once that happened, that gave an incentive for more people literally just to go over the border into D.C., and that's exactly what happened. So people literally began pouring from Maryland into D.C., and slave owners began complaining to the federal government about it. But once they got into D.C., they weren't able to retrieve their so-called property. And so over time, all these factors began to basically tap away at the power and weaken the power of slavery in Maryland.
That's a very powerful story. I think that's an important piece of our history, that how these things happen and how these things become part of our existence politically and socially in this country, and the efforts it takes and the different manipulations that make it move. And one of the things I really love about the book, Barbara Krauthammer, that you co-authored with Deborah Willis, I misspoke, Deborah Willis is coming, not Dr. Krauthammer, to Baltimore to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But the photographs in this book. It's the power of this new technology called photography and the role it played both in slavery, in enhancing slavery, but also in the abolition movement to end slavery and tell a different story. Talk a bit about that. And looking at these photographs, that's fascinating.
Right. Well, that was one of the aspects of this history that got us interested in doing this book was we, just through the course of our research, I'm a historian of slavery, and Deborah Willis, obviously being the leading scholar of African-American photography and photography history, we kept coming across pictures of enslaved people. And, you know, and I would say to her, I've never read anything about slaveholders photographing the people they owned. What could this mean? Why would people have done this? So we were really interested in thinking about that history of how this new technology of photography in the mid-19th century was used by defenders of slavery to show, to show black people as property, as objects, as luxury items, But then we were also really captivated by how somebody like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth turned around and said, I can use the camera to represent myself and my people and to tell our history and to show our dignity and our humanity and our beauty. And, you know, that basically there's a history of black activism through visual culture that we felt like hadn't really been put together in a single book about the 19th century, about the fight over slavery.
I mean, I think that we've seen, most of us seen, have seen a few of the pictures here and there from the period before the Civil War and after the Civil War that were taken, the photographs that were taken. But what you're uncovering is a really treasure trove of many more photographs. And I think that I was really fascinated by how both sides can use photography. Just, I was thinking about this in terms of Ferguson.
Right.
You saw what Twitter has done to galvanize a nation of young people to stand with the people in Ferguson and tell the story from the inside out. And this is a similar story in terms of what this photography did to transform the consciousness of this nation.
Right. And that was one of the things that was really striking to us as we did the research, as we started to look through libraries and some people opened their personal collections to us, that we found so many images that haven't been published and that haven't been seen of young, newly freed men and women putting on their best clothes, assembling their families for family portraits, and really documenting and asserting their presence and their rights as citizens and their sense of themselves as free people, as members of families and communities. I mean, very much in some ways like the young activists who were in Ferguson and who have gone to Ferguson and have really insisted upon telling that story of our communities in their own voices.
And I, you know, Lisa, and this is, I think one of the things, the powerful things about this also is, and I always think about this in history, the most important part of our kind of bringing history to life is its power to help us understand the present.
Right. Right. Absolutely. The photos, to me, show you how photography can be used in social justice and the whole history behind that and when that started. As I was looking through the book, I was so glad. It was interesting to see the photos. There's a certain set of photos called As We Found Them and then As They Are Now. And it shows that whole transformation of enslaved children that Barbara and Dr. Willis selected, of enslaved children from New Orleans as they were found and then being brought to the North and then being allowed education, just coming out of slavery, and how those abolitionist photos were basically used as a tool to help end slavery. Another arresting photo was Private Gordon.
Oh, yeah.
And that's so powerful of an African-American man who has been abused for years, apparently, and his back is to the front of the photo. So all you see is his exposed back with all these scars and keloids.
Right. That's a very famous photograph. Right,
yes.
Right, right.
And, you know, the caption was saying how, you know, you can read Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, but if you see his photo, that will really change minds.
Yeah, and so talk about it from your research, Dr. Gottheimer, about what effect these photographs had. Because you also talk about, there's an article in the New York Times also as well, you know, when you mentioned Louis Agassiz, the zoologist, and how he played the exact opposite role in this.
Right. Well, so the effect that I think the photographs of enslaved people had were really intended, right? So somebody like Agassiz, the scientist from Harvard, who commissions these photographs of African-born people and their American-born descendants with the goal of documenting, you know, quote-unquote, different species of humans was his intention. And so you really get a sense from those images of how the camera was used to dehumanize people. But then when we move through the abolitionist movement and through black people's own use of the camera as photographers and as subjects to humanize themselves, and you really again see that power of self-representation. And Frederick Douglass writes about it so beautifully, right, and says, photography is the most democratic medium in the country. Because if you can tell your own story, right, no one can take that power away from you, that voice that you have to say, I am here and I'm a person. So, you know, my favorite sets of pictures in the book, some of my favorites, are the family photographs of multiple generations of women who survived slavery and then pose with their freeborn children and grandchildren. And I think about sort of how powerful that must have been for women who were once forced to pose with their owner's children in their laps, right, and forced to pose as property of somebody else, to then be able to claim their own children for a family photo and sit, you know, with these freeborn grandbabies on their lap. It makes me cry every time I look at the pictures because I think how powerful that must have been.
Go ahead, Lisa.
She's also, they've also included some really key photos of the free African-American community. In particular, I love the photos that they chose of the McGill family. They are the free black family, early 19th century from Baltimore City, who really represent Baltimore City's large and growing free black community from that time. And members of that family all immigrated to Liberia and became important figures in the establishment of Liberia. And it makes that whole Maryland collection and connection of Maryland to Liberia.
That's a whole different discussion we can have just on the psychology of that moment of colonization back to the continent and people who said, no, we have to fight here, and that's emblematic of a discussion people still have today about whether to push and integrate more or to separate them. That is still very much a piece of it. That's really a fascinating piece of the story.
And she has a great photo of Frederick Douglass attending an abolitionist meeting with the Edmondson sisters and Thomas Garrett in New York. And the Edmondson sisters were enslaved in Washington, D.C. They had attempted to escape aboard a ship called the Pearl, and caught.
Right.
They were caught and they were sold into slavery with the possibility of actually being sold south to New Orleans. And thankfully, their families were able to raise money. They were able to establish connections with the abolitionist community, and they were able to retrieve the Edmondson sisters from slavery.
I'm so glad you mentioned that picture. That is another amazing picture, and that story of the Edmondson sisters is not one that's widely known in history books. And so the other thing that these photographs really allowed us to do and allowed us to show to people was the presence of black women activists, right? Black women engaged in politics and in that political struggle for freedom. Because in that photo, right, the Edmondson sisters are standing, beautiful, regal young women, standing alongside Frederick Douglass and Gerrit Smith, right, the leading male abolitionists of the day. And there are these two young women side by side in the center of the photograph. And we know from newspaper accounts that the two Edmondson sisters preached and sang and lectured to this audience of over 200 people about the need to fight the fight against slavery. And so the pictures really allowed us to bring to life women's roles in challenging slavery and offering a new vision of American freedom.
And they've included photos mentioning women of Susie King Taylor, who is a nurse, African-American nurse, who served in the South during the Civil War. And her husband was also a soldier, a part of the U.S. Colored Troops in the South. And they included Charlotte Fortin, beautifully attired with a book in her hand, likely representing that she was a teacher who went South, African-American teacher from the North who went South to the Sea Islands and taught. And the variety of pictures go on and on.
I mean, I think the power of these photographs in many ways, and to me what's really so amazing here, is that they give us this window onto a world of both oppression and slavery and repression, that when certain photographs are taken in the South by people who enslaved other people, but then it's a sense of hope and freedom and humanity that comes out of the other photographs that shows, I mean, that shows people have involved in their own agency for freedom and trying to build a new world. That to me is a really powerful juxtaposition.
Right, and that was really our goal, that we really wanted to show Black women and men shaping their own, not only their own lives, but really shaping the nation's history. And so we wanted to tell this story of emancipation and freedom through the eyes of those who fought that fight and those who lived to survive slavery, to enter that dawn of freedom. And so one of the stories that I like to tell, right, is that the Emancipation Proclamation, right, didn't free anybody.
Right.
What prompted Lincoln to consider and ultimately sign the Emancipation Proclamation was the actions of enslaved people freeing themselves. Right, and it was that grassroots movement of Black protest through movement, right, through people freeing themselves, Black organized protest about the Civil War and about the importance of making it a fight for freedom, that's in large measure what drives Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. And I think that's really a story that we need to put on center stage and tell again and again, of Black people's roles in shaping the future of the country and in defining what freedom means.
And I think hopefully in some ways that these kind of things can maybe inspire young people to realize the power they can have in this day.
Oh, I hope
absolutely.
So.
That to me is the power of our history and what it can do.
Absolutely.
First of all, I just want to thank Barbara Krauthammer and Deborah Willis both for the book they put out here. I think this
is really
important work. The history is a big piece of our programming. So will you be using your book to inspire me to do some other work in history? I really thank you so much for what you put out. She's associate professor of history and graduate program director at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. As I said, co-author of Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery. And her co-author, Deborah Willis, will discuss their book, Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum this Saturday. This Saturday?
Yes.
This is Saturday. Yeah. Already November, my goodness. This Saturday, November 1st at 1 o'clock. For information, call 443-263-1816 or visit rflewismuseum.org. And for those of you in the Washington area listening who cannot get up to Baltimore, Harriet Lynn just wrote into us that the Sandy Spring Museum is celebrating Maryland Emancipation Proclamation at the Sandy Spring Museum with an oral history performances, Emancipation Proclamation 150 years later. And you can visit their website for information. But do try to get to Baltimore, and do try to, if you're in Baltimore, please come to this piece. It'll be very important this Saturday at 1 o'clock. And we also want to thank our collaborator on the wonderful Lisa Crawley, Resource Center Manager for the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture, for being in the studio as well, and all the knowledge and wisdom she always brings to our show. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a brief break, and during this break, we're going to go out to break with a piece from the wonderful Melba Moore, singing Love's Coming at You. She was born on this day in 1945.